Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Today is the 12th of February, 2015, across the dateline here in Japan. Still the 11th of February back in the United States, where I am very happy to be joined on the line once again by our old friend Rick Rozoff of Stop NATO International at rickrozoff.wordpress.com, someone who I hope you will already be familiar with, and if not, please check out the Stop NATO website, and also please check out our previous conversations. He is a wealth of knowledge geopolitically, and he is a powerful voice in the anti-war movement. So, Rick Rozoff, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you once again, James, for having me. I think there's no more vital time time to be discussing it, or a vital issue than the Ukrainian crisis, and all it portends for global developments.
Well, Rick Rozoff, we are right in the middle of a news cycle right now that involves such developing stories as the ongoing attempts to negotiate a ceasefire between Ukraine and the internal Ukrainian opposition, between the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany, that's ongoing right now in Belarus, and so there will be some results from that probably by the time most people are catching this conversation. We've also seen other developments that have a role to play in what's happening right now. For example, on the front page of Stop NATO International right now, you have U.S. Congress readies $1 billion for war in Ukraine. Also, U.S. deploys more warplanes in expanding anti-Russian campaign. We have some other interesting things making headlines, like the recent telephone call between Obama and Putin that occurred on Tuesday, in which Obama apparently warned Putin that there will be consequences if Putin does not grasp the opportunity for diplomatic resolution of this Ukrainian crisis this week. And of course, we also have the downright absurd, like the recently released Pentagon report stating that Putin actually has Asperger's. No word yet on what particular mental ailments Obama has, but I think we can all speculate. But in this mix of ongoing events, there is obviously a lot to bite off and chew, and as I say, a lot of this will be decided in the time between the time we record this and the time this interview is released. So let's set the scope and the parameter for what's actually happening right now in the context of this ongoing NATO aggression against Russia and bumping up against Russia. How did this eventuate, and what are the things that people need to know that they probably do not about the way this conflict is taking shape?
This month marks a year exactly, the anniversary of the overthrow of the, unlikable in other respects, nevertheless, legally elected and internationally recognized government of then President Viktor Yanukovych. It was in February of 2014, of course, that with the act of connivance with the United States, and not only so-called non-governmental organizations, what I prefer to refer to as NNGOs, non-governmental organizations, that is front groups of the U.S. State Department, Central Intelligence Agency, not only were they working avidly, overtime, but the likes of John McCain, who now again is in charge of international affairs and other chief committees in the Senate, with his Republican Party having regained control of that house of the U.S. Congress, and of course the infamous Victoria Nuland, State Department's Undersecretary of State for European Eurasian Affairs, mingling amongst the protesters in Maidan Square in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev, handing out pastries and probably dollars and cell phones. I mean, who knows what was distributed through the U.S. Embassy and through the good offices of Jeffrey Pyatt, who was clearly the coup meister, if you will, the master of the coup d'etat that occurred a year ago. So, that by way of background. Immediately thereafter, the very man that in the intercepted or leaked a phone conversation with Victoria Nuland to Jeffrey Pyatt, wherein she used an obscenity in reference to the European Union, which, as I've stated repeatedly, is the least offensive part of that conversation, handpicked the composition of a post-coup Ukrainian junta, mentioning particularly that Arseniy Yatsenyuk would be head of government, which he is. He's prime minister and has been in the interim. Succeeded that was the launching of a full-fledged war. And I know a lot of people like to pull punches or like to make abstract or abstruse commentary on issues as though they're writing for the history books. That's not the sort of person I am, and I have no desire to, promote my own sagacity, by speaking about abstract issues. The long and short of it is, starting on April the 15th of last year, the U.S. and NATO supported puppet regime in Kiev, that of Petro Poroshenko, launched a series of military campaign, in fact, a war, which they referred to as an anti-terrorist operation, ATO, in the eastern part of the country, particularly in the Donbas region. It is now, as of today, 302 days old. That is, we're coming up on another anniversary, almost a year, of war in Europe. And the world has done a remarkable job, a despicable but a remarkable job at ignoring this, or to the extent it's paid any attention at all, to downplay the significance of it. Today, for example, English language Ukrainian government press agents and organs, have announced rather routinely that yesterday in the Donbas region, 19 Ukrainian government soldiers were killed, 78 wounded. That is almost 100 casualties in one day. So the fighting in the east has reached an unprecedented level of intensity and fatality. And it's clear it cannot go on like this much longer before somebody intervening. And I mean intervening militarily.
What is your take, then, on the ongoing negotiations for a ceasefire? Do you believe this is a delaying tactic? Is there an actual attempt being made to come to some sort of resolution here?
It is the most cynical of charades, and the fact that the Russian president would participate in them while his own country is, has a war on its border, to go through this, pretense of anything being resolved is a black mark against him, in my estimate. I don't know why he's humoring the likes, to shake hands with a murderer like Petroshenko, for the head of state of a legitimate country is a not only condescending, it's cheapening the role of the Russian government and the president of the country, in my estimate, to have any dealings with Poroshenko whatsoever.
Well, this obviously raises the greater question of NATO versus Russian military tensions and the sort of greater context of this. Is there some sense in which this is the flashpoint for that conflict to occur? Do you expect that this is going to result in some sort of outright military aggression, or is this a proxy war that's being fought right now?
It's a one-sided war. I'll be perfectly blunt and candid about this. It is a one-sided war being waged by the U.S. and NATO surrogate forces in Kiev, which, again, as I mentioned, have been fighting a war against its own people, the people of Ukraine, or the eastern Ukraine, for 302 days. This war has not only been, in some cases, as in Donetsk and Lugansk, maybe a score of miles from the Russian border. In many cases, the war is waging right on the Russian border and across into Russian territory. There have been incidents where the Ukrainian government military forces have shelled targets inside Russia, killed at least one Russian civilian, have attacked and destroyed Russian checkpoints and so forth with complete impunity. With complete impunity. That is, while the U.S. and NATO, and today's news is, I hope you get this on the air as soon as possible, is that the commander of U.S. Army Europe, General Benjamin Hodges, was in Kiev a couple of weeks ago, at which point he supposedly was distributing medals to not only Ukrainian government forces, but to the likes of the Pravi sector, that is the right sector-led Azov battalion of neo-fascist militia, and bestowing medals on them. He is quoted today as saying the U.S. is prepared to supply military weaponry to exactly the fighting forces in eastern Donbas, that is exactly to the aggressors in eastern Ukraine, and that, with the naked participation, the fact that the U.S. and NATO have entered this war as co-belligerents, by supplying military forces, by training Ukrainian government forces and so forth, and that there seems to be no countermeasures taken by Russia is a signal to me of something extremely dangerous going on, which is to say that, had it reached a military stalemate, and had Russia let it be known that certain steps would not be tolerated, I'm certain this catastrophe would never have reached the dimensions it has. It's the very fact that Russia has permitted the U.S. and NATO to act precisely as they've chosen to in Ukraine that has led to this crisis right now, which I am convinced is irreversible. And I am convinced that the side that is going to intervene militarily at this point is the United States and NATO, and you can count on it happening in the near future.
Well, absolutely all of the signs are tending in that direction, but that's an intriguing analysis because it seems to... Are you asserting Russian complicity in what's happening?
Complicity or capitulation, you take your choice.
Once again, I think one of the most interesting and worrying parts of this, of course, is what's happening right now to the Ukrainian people. And you have posted up as the top story as we speak on Stop NATO at rickrozoff.wordpress.com. Ukrainian junta ready to declare martial law in 302-day war. Just another inevitable sign of the erosion of any idea of civil society in Ukraine as a result of this this aggression that's being waged right now. Tell us about this and how this is going to affect the Ukrainian people.
Yeah, you know, I invite people to read the English language Ukrainian government or pro-government websites like Interfax Ukraine, Ukrinform, UNIN, National Radio Company of Ukraine. These are all available in English. You know, it's not a matter of speculating about what the regime is doing. They're quite open about it. Today, UNIN, it's an acronym, one of the major pro-government, if not government, media sources announced, again, it had been mentioned or bruited, a couple of days ago, that Poroshenko has stated quite openly that if the fighting continues in the eastern part of the country, in the Donbas region, he is prepared to institute a martial law throughout the country, the entirety of the country, not just the affected areas. Similarly, this is the second time he's made a statement to this effect in the last 72 hours or so. Similarly, a story in that same source, UNIN, mentioned a couple of days ago that the Ukrainian government is prepared to register for military purposes, perhaps conscript, all women between the ages of 20 and 50. So what you're looking at is something quite martial law, universal conscription, that's placing the entire country on a war footing. And it suggests that, you know, contrary to the assertions by the government, they're conducting a so-called anti-terrorist operation in the East. In fact, they're engaged in full-fledged civil war.
Very disturbing indeed, although not surprising, as you say, to the people who are keeping their eye on the situation. So what is the actual game plan here? The Ukraine is being targeted, and presumably for a reason. It was not picked randomly. What is NATO and the IMF and the EU and the other people with a stake in this conflict actually engaged in doing here?
You know, those of us, Cassandras like ourselves, James, let's be honest about it, you know, who constantly warn about certain events or see tendencies or trends emerging and try to point them out to people, oftentimes with, you know, very little response. I wrote an article 5 years ago suggesting the so-called Eastern Partnership Initiative of the European Union, and it was launched 6 years ago on the initiative of primarily of Sweden and Poland more than Sweden even. The foreign ministers of which at that time were the former U.S. resident and, you know, no doubt U.S. operative Radek Sikorski, who was foreign minister of Poland. He's now chief of their parliament. He was formerly a defense minister. He is, you know, mooted to become head of state at some point, prime minister, if not president, head of government, head of state. And Carl Bildt in Sweden, the foreign minister, who is a notorious Russophobe and a virulent NATO advocate. I don't know how many people in the world realize that, how many people in Sweden realize that. But they crafted a program called Eastern Partnership, which aimed at the economic and the military and the political and the ideological integration of those remaining former Soviet republics outside of Central Asia, excluding, of course, Russia. And they are, in fact, Belarus, Moldova, Ukraine, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. And the plan was to wean them away from autonomous alliances or organizations in former Soviet space, like the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is as close to a military bloc as exists within the former Soviet Union. Belarus and Armenia are members of that group, and they're targeted by the Eastern Partnership. And all six countries, excluding Georgia, as of immediately after the Six-Day War with Russia in August of 2008, are members of the Commonwealth of Independent States, which is the closest equivalent, say, to the European Union that exists within the former Soviet Union. And that, you know, my article 5 years ago suggested, because I thought it was transparently obvious, that this was part of a plan to wean the other former Soviet republics away from Russia, to destroy any, post-Soviet formations, and to recruit all non-Russian former Soviet republics into the European Union and into NATO, at least excluding the five Central Asian republics, as they're not within the geographical purview of either the European Union or NATO, but, you know, in some other capacity through partnership programs. And having warned about that, when last last November, the crisis in Ukraine erupted, and it erupted precisely because the an association agreement, capital A's in both instances, between the European Union and Ukraine under the auspices of the Eastern Partnership had simply been deferred by the Yanukovych government, which immediately gave rise to, you know, the sort of color revolution scenario we're all too familiar with, where, you know, swarms or, you know, rent-a-mobs, whatever we want to call them, you know, of people, of young people who seem to have nothing else to do. They have no jobs. They don't go to school, but they seem to be, you know, with all the latest telecommunication devices at their disposal, you know, are out in Maidan Square trying to restage the Orange Revolution activities of the year 2004, and one thing led to another, as we know. And again, a year ago, the internationally recognized government is overthrown in a violent uprising. The interim government stipulated and essentially appointed by the U.S. State Department took power, and shortly thereafter, as we've talked about, launched military operations against its own citizens in the east of the country. I mean, that was what we have to know. But we have to know that this, as you're indicating, this was a long planned objective of, you know, pulling Ukraine complete, I can't even say out of the Russian orbit. It had never been in the Russian orbit. I mean, Ukraine had never been a member of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, for example. You know, it had a 1,500-mile border with Russia and wasn't even a member of a, you know, post-Soviet security arrangement. It had been a member of several NATO initiatives, including permanent military deployments in the Indian Ocean and in the Mediterranean Sea.
You're speaking militarily, though. You're not suggesting that Ukraine was never in the economic orbit of Russia.
Very little. I mean, it was a member of the Commonwealth of Independent States, as were the 12 former Soviet republics, excluding the three Baltic states. So, you know, in that sense, I mean, that's a fairly loose affiliation. Of course, it will leave the Commonwealth of Independent States now. So the objective I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the description of the Eastern Partnership has been achieved. You know, that Ukraine has been wrenched out of any, you know, economic or political affiliations, organizations with which Russia is also a member. That's been accomplished. You know, I should mention an opposition member of the Verkhovna Rada, the parliament in Ukraine. There's a video going, making the rounds now, from Oleg Zarnov, where he talked last autumn, I think in October, November at the very latest, saying that the West, the U.S. and NATO, plans to overthrow the government in Ukraine and institute a civil war in the country. Now, I mean, that is not a wild guess. I think he had his ear pretty close to the ground. He understood what the plan was, and indeed, precisely that has ensued.
Well, you paint a very vivid and persuasive picture of the geopolitical machinations and the military aggression that has led us to this point, but the question obviously becomes, how do we actually effectively oppose this militarization, this military aggression, and support the people of Ukraine without giving into the logic which would say that what we need is Russian military to be the anti-aggressors, and then, you know, just supporting the war machine itself, which obviously relies on opposition. Military opposition to keep perpetuating itself. How do we actually insert ourselves in a fruitful way to stop this militarization?
You know, I wish I had a handy prescription for that. And if I did, I think it would be outdated the very moment I enunciated it. That is to say, that events are moving at such a rapid pace, they appear to be so irreversible. We have to keep in mind that we now have an airtight, hermetically sealed political system in the United States, particularly as it affects foreign policy issues, where there is absolute unanimity, or almost such, in both houses of the U.S. Congress. You know, 535 representatives in the House of Lords and the House of Commons, you can count on them voting unanimously to support any act of military aggression internationally, particularly against Russia. We've seen the Democratic Progressive Caucus, for example, vote to a person for the recent legislation that was basically a declaration of war against Russia to be, you know, filed away in one's jacket pocket, you know, for use as needed. So that we're not, you know, the decades-old and unfortunately no longer operative, you know, remedies like writing or calling your congressman, I think, can be safely dismissed at this point. Hoping, as, you know, certain people, whether with good intentions or otherwise, including many in the Kremlin, that the Ukrainian crisis would create a fissure between the U.S. and its European allies is transparently not materialized, and I would argue could not and will not be. You know, there will never be such open divisions until until NATO is disestablished, is abolished. And I might add, people who are enthusiastic about the recent change in the Greek government might look at the fact that the government has pledged fealty to both the European Union and NATO.
That's very true. And again, it leaves us in a position of being able to do almost nothing whatsoever, except watch as horrified onlookers as this continues, which is a very bleak way to end this conversation.
You're better the bitter truth than, narcotizing people with pleasant illusions, truthfully. And I think of nothing else, we may not be able to inspire people to go out and do heaven knows what right now, but we may be able to, very seriously instill in people the gravity of the situation we're confronting right now. I can't think of anything more grave. I don't want to raise this, but I certainly know that even the likes of, people not given to inflammatory and certainly not to anti-Western rhetoric like Mikhail Gorbachev has more than once raised the specter of the possibility of nuclear war between U.S. and Russia over Ukraine.
Rick Rozoff, I thank you for your time, and I look forward to talking to you again as these developments continue to unfold.
Thank you, James.